with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Thursday, February 12th, 2026. My name is Matthew Leck, in for Emma Vigeland, who would usually be in for Sam Cedar. We are broadcasting live, steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal, live in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Brendan James, Noah Colwin of the Blowback Podcast, talking about the Marco Rubio, Donald Trump, starvation of Cuba. Also on the program, Trump threatens Republicans who may vote against his tariffs, even though he could just override any legislation with a veto and give them the cover of not supporting his insane tariffs. But he doesn't want anything like that. Also, the IRS is illegally sharing info on taxpaying non-citizens with the DHS ICE Gestapo. That as ICE is losing hard drives that they're supposed to keep footage of detention centers on. At the same time, yeah, I can't find that hard drive that I had all those illegal movies on. Yeah. Of crime, snuff films on. My snuff film hard drive got... I was still looking for it. It might be at someone's house. And also, Texas lawmakers sound the alarm on killings and torture at the Fort Bliss Detention Center. Look up any detention center near you, folks, because you're going to want to be aware of any atrocities being committed in your backyards. Trump administration also continues its efforts to strip already naturalized citizens of their citizenship, something that had previously mainly been done for Nazis who lied about being Nazis in World War II. That sort of fraud is what typically has been looked at. Now it's probably going to be like, did you tweet anything negatively about Israel anytime in the past 3 years? The Pentagon, this is exciting news for everyone in America that's struggling with the cost of living. The Pentagon is sending a second aircraft carrier to the Middle East.
Oh, nice.
So everyone can feel safe over there. And then finally, Kerry Prigine Bowler, also as White House Religious Liberty Commission member following an anti-Semitism row. We'll probably get into that in the fun half. Kerry Prigine was the Miss California who was sort of anti-gay marriage, and now she's sort of pro-Candace Owens in a way that's not acceptable for the Republicans who want to use anti-Semitism as a big cudgel for their agenda. All that and more on today's Majority Report. Folks, I apologize for being in here and Emma not being here. She is still under the weather. Get well soon, Emma. Hopefully back tomorrow. But if not, Sam will be back, and maybe we can just give Emma some more time to recuperate. We have an announcement on something by a guy who's great at making these announcements, Tom Homan, the Border Czar. And let's let him sort of break the news here. This is something I hadn't heard about until it broke about 2 hours ago. And it's something that I don't want to rush to credit immediately, but I think it's still interesting to discuss. Anyway, here's Tom Homan.
With that, and success that has been made arresting public safety threats and other priorities since this surge operation began, as well as the unprecedented levels of coordination we have obtained from state officials and local law enforcement, I have proposed, and President Trump has concurred, that this surge operation conclude. A significant drawdown has already been underway this week and will continue through the next week. We have a lot of work to do across this country to remove public safety risk who shouldn't even be in this country.
What?
And to deliver on President Trump's promise for strong border security and mass deportation, law enforcement
officers
drawn down from this surge.
Yeah. Here, hold on. It's like he That wasn't a stream error, folks. He just sort of stopped talking mid-sentence.
It was a tongue error.
All right, here it is.
Maybe it was us. Let's give him another chance.
Shouldn't even be in this country. And to deliver on President Trump's promise for strong border security and mass deportation, law enforcement officers drawn down from this surge operation will either return to the duty station or be signed elsewhere to achieve just that.
Now, since Tom Holman was sent to Minnesota to basically change faces with Bovino, they've been talking about this drawdown. And I don't think it should be credited that it's going to happen immediately or at all. But I do think it's true that they can't stay occupying our cities forever. And the other thing he mentioned, in addition to the success they've had by killing two people, arresting hundreds of people who are just out there protesting the kidnapping of their fellow citizens, they can't occupy the city for more. And in addition to those things, like I said, he also mentioned the protests were making it difficult for them to stay in there. And there's a little bit of politics here because they don't want to show weakness. And they have to play politics both ways. There's an extent to which, like, people like us on the left, like I said, don't want to rush to credit this because we've heard this sort of thing before. And even since Holman has got there, there's been horrific incidents. There was a car crash in St. Paul just yesterday. But also, it is untenable. This is massively unpopular. People hate this, and people are getting better and better at responding to it. And they're not being afraid. They're not being made afraid, despite two people being murdered on camera, and everyone saw it. And the administration lied about it. And what did people do? They continue to show up and protest these people. They continue to play drums outside their hotels, continue to show up to the Whipple Building, which is a concentration camp once again in that area, which is a history of that going back to 1862. And it's really great. And let's move now to this Cato Institute guy. What's this fellow's name?
David J. Beer.
Yeah, and there's Cato Institute's not my preferred, think tank. But on immigration, they'll make points very well. And this is, David Beer, of the Cato Institute, Director of Immigration Studies. And he's talking about this concept of fraud, which we're hearing a lot about. And it's important to know, like, a drawdown of the Gestapo still leaves a Gestapo with a budget greater than the FBI's annually. They're going to want to occupy more cities going forward. And the important thing is not that it's done in a orderly way. It's that it's not acceptable at all. This is a fever of hysteria that we are going through with immigration. There are two main planks. One, the economy is not delivering for normal people. And there's no plans from the Republicans to make it do that. And also, they are a minoritarian party in a democracy. So they need another thing to point to for why they lose elections. That's it. That's why we gave an agency with killer goons a budget greater than the FBI so they can march around our cities pretending that there's a solution to those issues. But here's the Cato Institute guy.
Member Padilla and distinguished members of the subcommittee, thank you for the opportunity to testify. For nearly half a century, the Cato Institute's research has shown that people of any ancestry, background, or birthplace can be assets in a free society. America's immigrants exemplify this truth. Despite often leaving terrible conditions abroad, immigrants work, start businesses, and invent at higher rates than the U.S.-born population. Cato's recent analysis shows that immigrants reduced deficits by $11.5 trillion over the last 30 years, including about $140 billion in Minnesota. Although welfare fraud is a serious problem, immigrants aren't to blame. Non-citizens account for just 5% of welfare fraud losses, 31% less per capita than U.S. citizens. Rather than targeting entire ethnic groups, Congress should end the broken welfare systems, namely the oversight-free aid to states that led to all the fraud in Minnesota.
This is the Cato Institute stuff.
DHS isn't anti-fraud. DHS is itself, openly carrying out the largest fraud in the history of the U.S. immigration system. DHS and the State Department are raking in billions of dollars in immigration fees and not providing the adjudications that applicants are entitled to. For individuals for over 90 countries, half of all legal immigrants, the administration is simply not processing their applications. The burden of proof is already on these applicants. DHS and state can deny anyone who fails to make their case. Instead, this administration is pocketing thousands of dollars from hardworking Americans and their relatives, including spouses and minor children of U.S. citizens, and then not even looking at their applications. This is a scam. It is fraud. DHS's entire Minnesota operation is another kind of scam sold to the public on lies. DHS hasn't criminally charged anyone with fraud there, and 60% of its immigrant arrests in Minnesota have no criminal convictions or charges. DHS itself classifies just 8% of its arrests in Minnesota as the highest threat level, and 3/4 of arrests it classifies as not being a threat at all. Instead of arresting fraudsters, it's seeking to jail 5,600 legal vetted refugees, nursing mothers, single parents, long-term residents, already dragged away from their families without any evidence of fraud at all. Rather than a law enforcer, DHS has become the biggest lawbreaker in America today. In less than a year, DHS has attacked the first, the second, the fourth, fifth, sixth, eighth, 10th, 14th amendments to the U.S. Constitution, the writ of habeas corpus, the independent judiciary, and much more. Every day, masked DHS agents detain Americans based on their race and demographics. They arrest legal immigrants for criticizing their foreign policy and Americans for recording them doing it. They threaten, assault, and even shoot people for exercising their First and their Second Amendment rights. They break into our homes without judicial warrants. They sentence legal immigrants to foreign prisons without trials. They are trying to strip the citizenship of Americans born in this country. They detain people without lawful basis, and they ignore court orders to release them. And of course, they lie about all of it. Combating fraud and upholding the rule of law is important, but the public cannot have faith in that effort by an administration that regularly gets away with fraud, lies, and lawlessness. Even the FBI.
Yeah, and you know, I appreciate his anger there. And besides the point about fraud, which I would emphasize is mainly an issue with the contractors we put in charge. Oh yeah, set, go.
Haven't been solo in a while.
Ryan's not used to the squiddly diddly in it. It's very important though, the thing about the stats about even by DHS's own numbers, that they're not going after the high risk individuals. These new hires that, you know, are signing up for a bonus that they can spend on a truck, they can drunk drive in. They're not keen to go after the scary guys. They want to go after people who are like unarmed because they're going into a court or because they're at a school being a teacher's assistant, because that's an easier way to get their quota up. And all of their propaganda, DHS is... look at this rapist we took off the street. This is what the Democrats are afraid of. Well, first of all, cops can deal with those folks. That's what we have cops for. We don't need to create a whole new goon squad, federal Gestapo, to go march around and shoot our citizens in the face and stake out schools because some idea that if you're an immigrant or not an undocumented person, you can commit rapes in this country. That's just not the case. And we don't need to – we can also lock them up in our own jails. this whole sort of thing is absolutely ludicrous. But yeah, I mean, it's We're going to need a lot of people to break on this. And the Cato Institute, like I said, I'm not a fan of their libertarian politics. But on immigration, like even Chase Oliver, the candidate who Dave Smith stole the libertarian support for instead and gave it to Donald Trump, he had probably the best position on immigration of all the candidates in the 2024 race. We are going to be joined by Noah Colwin and Brendan James to talk about Cuba in just a second, but I have some ad reads to do here. First, Rocket Money. You've heard of this, Brian?
I sure have. I think we said on the last time we had this ad read that Rocket Money revealed that I was paying for Rocket Money since 2022.
That's how you know you can trust it. It's because, like, I hate to tell you this, Brian, but you already got a Rocket Money subscription. The dual Rocket Money subscription. So, Rocket Money has helped us cut spending in a specific category, like a monthly internet subscriptions. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that helps find and cancel your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so you can grow your savings. And we'd like to thank Rocket Money for sponsoring today's episode. We already described how Rocket Money has helped Brian track his subscriptions.
I also caught a Bulwark subscription, too.
Ooh.
I don't know how I got that.
Yeah, that's rough. There was a Substack that I don't want to say who it was, but it's a journalist who has fallen out of favor. And I realized that I had briefly subscribed to that and kept the thing going. It's like, you gotta pull the plug on that. Talk about, the transaction categorization across accounts, customizable categories and tags. Reveal spending patterns and add context. This pattern of buying a lot of video games on Steam. Let Rocket Money help you reach your financial goals. Go to rocketmoney.com/majority to join. That's rocketmoney.com/majority. Do it, folks. And another ad. I don't know if you had the same experience with this, that you found out you already had a will, Brian, but...
Definitely not.
Right now, and for a while, we've been experiencing economic uncertainty thanks to technology, politics, tariffs and taxes, and technology being AI, and the market, or recent market falls and spikes. Many of us are probably underinsured, overpaying, and underprotected, especially if your policy is through your job. One way to protect your future is through life insurance with SelectQuote. Life insurance is something that, especially if you're a father like Sam, probably an acute anxiety, actually not probably, definitely an acute anxiety for folks like that. And I know this has taken a lot of that worry away. For over 40 years, SelectQuote has been one of the most trusted brokers in insurance, helping more than 2 million Americans secure over $700 billion in coverage. Their mission is simple: to find you the right insurance policy for your unique needs. They shop, you save. Unlike other one-size-fits-all life insurance companies, SelectQuote's licensed agents work for you. In as little as 15 minutes, they'll compare policies from top-rated carriers to find you the best fit for you. And they work for you for free. Head to selectquote.com/majority and a licensed insurance agent. I don't know why I would have thought it said, and a licensed insurance agent will call you right away with the right policy for your life and your budget. No medical exam, no problem. They partner with providers offering same day coverage up to $2 million without needing to visit your doctor, have high blood pressure, diabetes, or heart disease. SelectQuote has partners with policies designed for many pre-existing health conditions, so you get the protection you deserve. Life insurance is never cheaper than it is today. SelectQuote, they shop, you save. Get the right life insurance for you for less and save more than 50% at selectquote.com/majority. Save more than 50% on term life insurance at selectquote.com/majority to get started. That's selectquote.com/majority. We're going to take a quick break here, and we'll have Brendan and Noah in. We are back. Welcome back to the Majority Report, folks. Returning to the show, Brendan James and Noah Colwin of the Blowback Podcast. Guys, thanks for being here. We have, I mean, you're never really talking about that cheery of topics, frankly, when you're here, but we got another atrocity America's committing. So Cuba, just for folks, let's start with you, Noah. Why is Cuba in the news right now, as opposed to, say, like our long-term strangulation of that country?
Sure. So in the wake of the kidnapping of Venezuelan leader Nicolas Maduro in early January, shortly thereafter, the U.S. began making noises about how Cuba was next on the list. And the way that it is manifested most dramatically is Trump's threat to issue massive tariffs on any country that sends fuel, in particular oil, most of all, to Cuba right now. And consequently, because Cuba does not produce enough oil to keep its grid running and to meet the needs of its own country, this has resulted in a slow siege that is picking up steam in Cuba, which is, you know, kids are being sent home from school. There's no power. They have massive power outages as a result of this intensified action. And it is not clear what the Trump administration is after beyond just trying to see if they can foment a collapse of the government at the price of, you know, negatively affecting the lives of, you know, almost 10 million people.
And Brendan, can you talk about you've both returned from Cuba a couple of weeks or a week or change ago. Can you tell folks why you were there and what you saw there? We can't hear Brendan, so let's just take a real, unless he's muted, so we can maybe take a quick break and sort that out. Just cut to a new break. And all right, so yeah, Brendan, like I was asking you, you guys returned from Cuba. Why'd you go there and what'd you see?
We had heard that there was the probability of increased pressure on Cuba. And we thought, we were also in Latin America to cover a sort of conference or summit in Bogota in Colombia, Nuestra America, which sort of had, was an interesting prelude to what happened in Cuba over the next few days, because the summit was about increased cooperation, or the goal of increased cooperation and solidarity at the moment of a lot of aggressive actions taken by the Trump administration, the kidnapping of Venezuela's leader being the most prominent. But then we got to Cuba, and there was, while we were there, this new measure of cutting off the island from any of its regularly scheduled fuel deliveries, chiefly and most importantly from Mexico. So that happened while we were there. You know, it was just coincidence, but we were able to speak to people and listen mostly to what the anxieties and what the expectations were going forward from this new move by the Trump administration.
What, you know, that wider political context of the Caribbean states, I'm curious either of your perspectives on that, because the Maduro thing, like you said, Claudia Sheinbaum in Mexico has been sort of lamenting the embargo. I'm not sure, has she actually, have they sent, I'm not sure what the status is of if they're going to send oil, but
they're curious, not. They've sent aid. And there are aid deliveries being made. I think the latest country to announce that they're sending aid is Chile, and that comes on the heels of China and Russia. But nobody is sending oils, and all of the statements are qualified and caveated tremendously. You know, for example, the Chinese statement says that they will help Cuba to the best of its ability. And so none of these governments I've seriously talked about sending oil against the American demands.
I believe yesterday Russia did say it would send fuel, quote unquote, soon. But that's about all that at least the Reuters report that I saw said.
I mean, that's the thing is like all of this acting in like, I mean, maybe intensifying of American imperialism. I think it could be interpreted as weakness, but it doesn't seem like the rest of the world is interpreting it that way. I'm curious your guys' perspective on that.
You go ahead.
I think one way of looking at it is that just because something is in decline doesn't mean that it's not dangerous. And while it is true, I think that America's ability to project power in the way that it has that made the 20th century the so-called American century, well, that may be slipping. And we see evidence of how that kind of rot is growing from within day by day. You know, some animals get quite dangerous when they're cornered. Or when they're sick. And I think that many countries are understandably concerned about the capacity of the United States to deal damage in such a state.
When we were in Bogota for that summit, I remember the Mexican delegates were more from like the kind of bureaucratic, government side of things. They weren't party leaders or sort of ideologically charged in their statements. They already seemed to be, you know, hoping for, yes, increased cooperation, yes, a defensiveness against any of these new volatile and destructive measures from the United States. But ultimately, they sounded, you know, fairly pragmatic and moderate. What then happened was the concession, at least for the moment, a few days later, while we were in Cuba. Sheinbaum has been able to handle Trump pretty well during the second term. And I know the people we spoke to in Cuba hoped that there was some longer term plan to handle this and not simply have this be the end of the line. But it was I don't think it's a contradiction in terms for this to be a weaker and more desperate version of Washington lashing out while still causing horrible damage and destruction in some of these places.
Yeah, America's been intervening, has its thumb on Cuba ever since the overthrowing of the Batista sort of plantation gambling regime. I'm curious how you would put this in the context of that long-term, strangulation of this country.
Yeah. Thomas Jefferson thought Cuba should have been an American state the first stirrings of American imperialism, as we kind of understand the term, expressed themselves. It was in the character of the same forces that brought about the Monroe Doctrine, which today we know Donald Trump has repurposed as the Donroe Doctrine, and this idea that American dominance over the Western Hemisphere, United States dominance over the American hemisphere is perhaps a better way to put it, prevails, eternity, I suppose. A pretty clear retrenchment in the face of clear shortcomings against the fact that America's weaker than China and so forth. I think that that is the latest incarnation of, as you describe, what is a long heritage of U.S. Impunity in dealing with the little countries that populate the global South, and that the U.S. has pretty uniformly supported the most reactionary elements in order to prevent forces of social change and progressivism from developing. And in that respect, yeah, I don't think that you can really, look at what the U.S. is doing in Cuba at this moment or doing to Cuba at this moment and say that it's all that different.
Yeah, and this is sort of stuff that Blowback covers, these sorts of I mean, grand, horrific events of imperialism, but it does seem like we're in a period of like an end game. Whereas whether the West Bank stuff and Gaza, the Maduro thing, I'm curious, like that's where we're at right now globally. Isn't that right?
I think that there is, in the case of Cuba, to stick with that for a moment, you know, you have this odd mixture of MAGAism that's announcing everything as a bold and up until now unconsidered brilliant strategy to finally get American interests on the table for many of these countries. Yet it's coexisting with old-fashioned neocon speak and ideology, because Marco Rubio, who's an old neocon, he's, you know, I know he's tried on some different hats over the past few years, but when it comes to these things, and especially Cuba, because, you know, he himself is Cuban and dreams, it's been his dream to preside over the fall of the Cuban government as it's existed since the revolution. He's the one actually calling the shots and making policy. And as Noah reported with others at, was it Drop Site, Noah? You'll have to remind me. The other day, he has been telling even his own president that, oh yeah, we're in touch with the Cubans. I'm handling it. Whereas the Cubans themselves have said, we are not in any kind of dialogue right now, even though they would probably welcome it. So the, even just the letterhead saying MAGA, but then all of the policy details being in neocon speak about the rescuing the Cuban people, delivering the Cuban people a new government. That's the old school stuff of, you know, back to Kennedy and this continuity we've been discussing, strangling the island so that it will, you know, burning the village to save it, or whatever you want to call it. So it'll pass into a new phase of good relations with America, and most importantly, new markets for America and its friends. But Trump himself, while I'm sure he's very ignorant of all this, he may be considering, without Rubio telling him what to do all the time, that this could be like Venezuela, where they swooped in and they made a bold and, you know, to many people, horrifying gesture that then resulted in a deal getting made for the benefit of Americans, which would follow up at least ideologically with the MAGA, framing of everything. So is Trump thinking that we'll squeeze them until they're ready to pop, and then I'll get, you know, some exclusive rights for America back into Cuba? I'll do a different version of what Obama did, which he welcomed in at the end of Obama's second term, but said it should have been a better deal, as he usually said about anything, you know, Obama did. That's a very different track than Marco Rubio. And I don't know if anyone knows which track we're actually on, or which place we'll end up.
Yeah, I mean, I saw a tweet about Trump saying he didn't want to put Machado in power because she didn't have any sort of backing, and as like looking like it being so unexpected that it's like a dog playing chess. And then immediately we have this sort of right wing Cuban. Let's talk about the right wing in Cuba. First, I want to ask about the right wing, the Cuban right wing in America, because they've played a huge role for over a half a century since the Cuban Revolution. And Marco Rubio is, I guess, one of the main figures in that now, that history. Could you just historicize that a bit for us, Noah?
Sure. So the Cuban-American diaspora is an incredibly sort of potent and reactionary force in American domestic politics. The largest sort of population center of Cuban-Americans is, of course, Southern Florida and Miami. But there are actually lots of Cubans throughout the United States, particularly in northern New Jersey and New York City. And the U.S. government, essentially beginning in the early 60s with the, you know, kind of consolidation of the communist government in Cuba, began cultivating Cuban Americans as kind of, their own Contras, their own counter-revolutionary militias, as well as, soft political force as well, creating huge government-funded propaganda outfits, make-work jobs for, you know, to essentially keep the anti-communist cause going. And Florida also became a swing state for a quarter century plus, a very valuable piece of contested political real estate every 4 years. And the Cuban Americans, you know, similar historically, you could argue to say like Jews in New York City, they were a very effective and well-organized ethnic political bloc in Florida. And the influence that they were able to exert over, you know, I mean, the Bush family was very involved in the Cuba lobby. And so like it became a constituent part of both political establishments, also much like the pro-Israel lobby. And to this day, there exists like a pretty well-coordinated and powerful Cuban-American diaspora among the American political elite and in media that are able to shape the dominant portrait that most Americans have of what life is like in Cuba, what its political leadership is like, and why it's worth it for us to continue, you know, torturing that little island nation. Because many of them, yes, are directly descended or have, you know, ties in rolling back the clock in Cuba. But also many of them, I mean, it's become a cause even bigger than the idea now. And the Cuba America lobby is a, you know, it is a powerful force in some corners of American politics.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's fast. I think it's an important example to point out in this day and age that like Zionism isn't the only right wing nationalism that has a finds fertile ground in our political system. How about in Cuba? Did you notice much? Was there a lot of Rubio supporters in Cuba when you were there?
I didn't spot any, but my eyes are going in my old age. Maybe there was a lot of pro Marco. We did hear a couple of people call him Little Narco. I don't even want to say that in case it pisses him off more. But yeah, I mean, there's a lot of as you might expect, there's a lot of awareness of the position and the power that Rubio has in this new Trump government there right now. And we talked a lot about that with people. I mean, as far as a right wing in Cuba, this is not like Venezuela. Cuba has had a much longer political and social sort of, homogeneity since the revolution. Whereas in Venezuela, you have your like Venezuelan versions of Fox News where they called, you know, Chavez, Hitler too, or maybe they like Hitler, but they called him Stalin too, or whatever. And you can kind of, you can actually see, a more divided and, nasty, political showdown. That's not really the case in Cuba. So the center of power for any kind of reaction is in Miami and in Washington, which is partly why I think that there is this sort of wait and see attitude at the moment, at least from observers like us, but also I'm sure maybe to a certain degree to Marco Rubio himself. I mean, he was really feeling himself that week we were there and a couple of days after, but as we've, you know, all adjusted to with the Trump era, now eyes are on Iran tomorrow. Maybe it'll be Greenland again. Maybe it'll be someplace totally new. So I think in order to build a consensus, the way that the Bush administration, for example, did, incredibly deliberately for the period of a year and a half, if not longer, before the invasion of Iraq, for some large scale or significant action against Cuba, right now it's just one of many plates that they've got spinning. And while people are very scared there, and we had some friends who, you know, said as we left, they said, you know, hope to see you again, either because they maybe have to move or they have to flee, or something worse, it still doesn't entirely seem like the administration knows what it wants to do. Hence why Rubio says, oh yeah, we're having discussions, and the Cubans aren't even privy to that.
Yeah, for folks wondering like what Cubans want, I mean, I think generally it'd be a normalization of trade relations with the rest of the world. What other like sort of demands did you hear from folks, or I mean desires did you hear from folks when you were there?
I mean, I think a lot of it's the same as what anybody wants, you know. They really, they would like to have electricity all the time. They would like to have enough energy to run the country. They would like to, you know, for people who are starting businesses in Cuba to be able to, like, do business internationally and bring in foreign exchange and help stabilize the economy and let it participate normally in the world economy. I think people would like it to make it easier to have relationships with people in the United States. Cuba is 90 miles off the Florida coast, and many Cuban families in Cuba are both, you know, linked by blood and by economics with family in the United States. And a huge chunk of what also has to happen is a process by which those relationships can be eased as well. To me, there's a very clear that when you talk to people that, you know, there is a at least I found an incredible sense of curiosity about what the average American thinks, whether or not they can really stand Donald Trump. And then also, you know, a sort of, you know, a bewilderment about, like, why is the U.S. care so much? Like, why are they doing this? Because it isn't, it's not the logic to them is even, you know, aside from just putting it in the context of history. I mean, we can all do that. That still doesn't answer the immediate, satisfy the immediate reality. And I think it's the sense of tragedy is heavy.
Yeah, you know, I asked that because we got a comment about civil liberties, and I have no shyness about talking about civil liberties in other countries, but I will warn folks that, like, when we're talking about places like Cuba or Venezuela, I can't, and I'm curious what your guys' perspective is. I think it's ludicrous to divorce that from the, like, say, how we've tried to assassinate their heads of state for years and years and years. But I'm just curious what you would respond to somebody who asks you to talk about civil liberties in Cuba.
Here's how I would respond. They're at war. If they're currently asking or piping up about civil liberties in Ukraine, then I guess power to them. They're checking everybody off the list. But if they're not currently talking about how there's no elections in Ukraine, how Ukraine has shut down free press, how Ukraine has had to curtail what was considered some kind of liberal order, I don't really see why they're so interested in Cuba, which is also at war, or Venezuela, which has been threatened by war, but actually had more liberties than this questioner may be aware. I don't know why they're so curious about the one case and not the other. And that, I think, has been the mentality since the revolution. It hasn't just been assassinations, by the way, assassination attempts and successful assassinations. There's been obviously threatened invasions. There have been CIA operations and terrorism inside of the country. There have been homegrown terrorists from Cuba cuddling up with the U.S. and then hijacking planes. Murdering people, networks that stem from the United States, trying to infiltrate Cuba. It's war. And no sensible country would be expected to dot the I's and cross the T's of an American observer popping off about it because they hear that, you know, there is that whole one-party state problem there. What's that about? Well, I think a glance at the history answers that question. And I would just say again, if you don't have a problem with the Ukrainians doing what they need to do in a time of war, then I don't know why you're picking on the Cubans.
Yeah, I think any liberal in America should be able to understand that war is not conducive to civil liberties in our current environment after the Department of Homeland Security. Yeah, go ahead, Noah.
Well, I would also add that it's like, you know, like, we're not also just like, you know, like what does it mean that they're at war? Like, our government actively funds organizations, you know, whether it's, you know, historically been through the National Endowment of Democracy. By the way, organizations that have been able to keep the lights on despite all the DOGE cuts to other organizations under this funding purview, because after DOGE cut them, Rubio turned the money spigot back on for this stuff. You know, they actively, they are trying to sustain a narrative on social media about Cuba that, like, reality can't support. And, you know, like, political prisoners exist in Cuba. As we said, it's both a country at war, and our government, the government we ostensibly, are supposed to have some influence over, or at the very least are implicated in by virtue of, you know, it's our government. where we have citizenship, where we vote. Our government is the one actively trying to, you know, develop wedges in civil society there for the purpose of sowing enough disorder to lead to a, you know, spontaneous collapse of the state there. leading to intense suffering more than we already have. It's just, to me, not it's not a credible concern.
This is one of this. The one thing that is very clear that we got while we were there is this is worse than the special period, which if people don't know, was the period after the collapse of the USSR, which was thought to be maybe the high point of the apocalyptic breakdown of the socialist bloc and any country that was left standing after that happened. For many years, it was thought that those were the worst times. They're behind us. After the Obama thaw, which was then interrupted by Trump, he slapped on turbo sanctions. Trump did. Biden did not remove them. COVID happened, of course, in the middle of that. Things got worse. And everyone was saying this is as bad as the special period, if not worse. Now, this is unprecedented, this level. And to say, I'm sorry, but to say from the comfort of your spot, wherever you are in America, you know, and say, well, are they letting people blog enough? I just don't know where that impulse comes from. At least I can't speculate as to where that impulse comes from. So
yeah,
that's what we saw.
It's not a liberal. I think it comes from the impulse to blame this on Marxism instead of American imperialism. Like, as if they want to say it's just him doing a Stalin, or Cuba doing a Stalin. So Americans need to save them for freedom, as you know, Department of Homeland Security has developed into a Gestapo, and we look at people's visas for if they've criticized Israel. So how this has been going on? Where do we stand now with this policy? You've mentioned the sort of Marco Rubio obfuscation about whether there's dealings going on or not. Do you think this will ever penetrate Trump, or is he just too distracted? Like, what's the sort of outlook here?
I think the immediate outlook is pain and suffering for Cubans. And we've really not seen any individual country actually take steps to move against the U.S. edict that no oil go to Cuba. I think, you know, we shall see if the plight in Cuba is able to break through the American news cycle right now. Because I'll tell you, Cuba's already in pretty catastrophic straits. And it doesn't really seem to be getting adequate attention in the United States. Not that there isn't a whole bunch of other worthy, you know, stuff for inclusion in the day's headlines these days. But the reality is that, you know, Rubio is surely able to get away with going over Trump's head and making sure that there is no negotiation going on, despite that evidently, at least in Trump's mind, being some part of the plan. Because, like, you know, Cuba... maybe, you know, it's a low intensity W for them. You know, they get to put on the sanctions, they slowly squeeze, and hey, maybe something happens that they, you know, because they, Lord knows they've tried for 70 years through a bunch of other means that haven't failed. But, you know, let's try a new experiment. Let's do a Gaza in slow motion. Let's starve a place of any resources, any capacity for, you know, like the basic requirements for human flourishing, and see what happens. It's like that's the test. And whether the world acts against Trump, whether American politicians decide to act against Trump, or at the very least apply some pressure, motivated by the images and footage and real news, not fake news, but real news that we see come out of Cuba in the coming months, that's as much as I can say with any certainty about what's coming if things don't change.
Brendan James and Noah Colwin of the Blowback podcast. What's the website people can subscribe to Blowback?
Blowback.show.
Blowback.show. I am a proud subscriber of that show. It's great. The most recent season on Angola and South Africa. Is there anything to announce coming up? Or you guys have still been releasing on that series. Isn't that right?
We will be announcing our seventh season very, very shortly, which will be coming out later in the year. But we have already announced a mini series. It's our first time doing this, a 3-episode, shorter form mini series about the low points, the points of tension, the points of conflict between the United States and Israel, because we all know it's a very close relationship, but it is not one that has not had its peaks and valleys. So that's the mini series we'll be releasing in, I would say, early May.
There you go, folks. There's not a smarter history podcast going. Thank you, Brendan and Noah, so much for your time today, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Good to talk to those guys. I'm genuinely a huge fan of their work. Do we have Binder and Brandon in? Or do you want to take a little break?
They are not in just yet, but I bet Brandon's listening, and I bet he'll log in right as I finish this sentence.
Okay, cool. Well, I'll just plug my stuff.
Yeah, plug your stuff.
I guess I can stretch out and have a little mat time. tomorrow we have a new Jacobin show. I'm not sure which of our interviews we are going to be talking about there. So, but do subscribe to the Jacobin Meg YouTube channel. David Griscom and I were given the keys to that show, which was started by Michael Brooks 6 years ago, some long ass time ago. We've been building it up back up after a little bit of a hiatus. It's a very well polished show, and I export it at very high quality. And there's like chyrons and stuff on it. So check that out tomorrow at 10 o'clock a.m. Eastern time and every Friday. And we also had a Left Reckoning. Left Reckoning, which was on Tuesday. And I always forget what we do every week. But go check out Left Reckoning and subscribe to us on Patreon, because we'll be doing a Sunday show. Probably getting into some... If you're a Texas politics follower... You need to be following Left Reckoning, because Griscom is all over the Tallarico Crockett stuff. He's all over Taylor Remmett. He had a piece in the Jacobin show, Jacobin magazine, about Remmett. You got something to say there, Brian?
You can finish your plug. I was going to plug Emma's stuff too.
Yeah, go ahead and plug Emma's. What's she got?
March 22nd, she's going to be at the Dynasty Typewriter in Los Angeles, California, yeah, doing a live bituation room with Francesca Fiorentini. I think that's at 8:30, but tickets are still available. And you may be confused. Dynasty Typewriter is also the Hayworth Theater. So the marquee says Hayworth, but it's actually called Dynasty Typewriter. Whatever.
It's like a what do they call that? In the speakeasy. It's like a speakeasy show.
Right. And then
code.
And then also Emma's hosting Griscom's book event in New York. I'm trying to remember. I'm looking up where that is.
That's true. I don't know if it's worth plugging, though, because that's all sold out. So you're going to just need to buy David Griscom's book, folks, because you ain't going to get into that event,
right,
as far as I'm concerned. But David Griscom's book is coming out soon, and it is selling well from what I can hear, because people are very interested in hearing a lefty talk about Texas politics. Matt Binder... Can you hear me?
I can. Can you hear me?
We can in 1 second here. I think we might have to re-enter Binder into... let's just take a real quick break here, and then we can... Not the fun half, just the news break, so we can get the...
Be right back.
Matt Binder, what do you have going on Doomed and your other various media offerings?
Just plug in Leftist Mafia tonight at 8:30 p.m. Eastern time at youtube.com/Matt Binder.
All right. Well, check that out tonight, folks. We'll be back with Brandon Sutton and some interesting clips to have a little bit of fun with. We'll see you in a little bit, folks.
Okay, Emma, please.
Well, I feel that my voice is sorely lacking on the majority report.
Wait, whoa. Look, Sam is unpopular.
I do deserve a vacation at Disney World. So, ladies and gentlemen, it is my pleasure to welcome Emma to the show.
It is Thursday.
I think you need to take over for Sam.
Yes, please.
No, I'm gonna pause you right there.
Wait, what?
You can't encourage Emma to live like this. And I'll tell you why.
So was offered a tour, sushi, and poker with the boys. Sushi and poker with the boys. Who was offered a tour?
Yeah.
Sushi and poker with the boys.
What?
what you did to Tim Pool was mean.
Free speech.
That's not what we're about here. Look at how sad he's become now. We shouldn't even talk about it. I think you're responsible. Well,
I probably am in a certain way, but let's get to the meltdown here.
Twerk, sushi, and poker with the boys.
Oh my god.
Twerk,
wow.
Sushi. I'm sorry, I'm losing my fucking mind. Someone's offered to twerk, sushi, and poker with the boys.
Logic.
Twerk, sushi, and poker with the boys. Boy, twerk. I think I'm like a little kid. I think I'm like a kid.
Add this debate 7,000 times.
I'm losing my fucking mind.
Some people just don't understand.
So I'm not trying to be a dick right now, but like, I absolutely think the U.S. should be providing me with a wife and kids.
That's not what we're talking about here.
Okay, all right. It's not a fun job. Twerk?
That's a real thing. That's real thing.
Willy Wonka twerk?
That's a real thing.
That's real thing.
What's that
offered to twerk?
That's a real thing.
That's real thing.
Or that's
twerk?
A real thing.
That's real thing.
What's
that offered to twerk?
Ladies and gentlemen, Joe Rogan has done it again.
That offered to twerk?
That's a real thing.
That's poker with the boys.
I think he might be blowing it out of proportion.
Real thing.
That's poker with the boys.
That offered to twerk?
That's a real thing.
That's poker.
Let's go, Joe.
What's going on? Live YouTube.
Sam has like the weight of the world on his shoulders.
Poggers.
Sam doesn't want to do this show anymore. It was so much easier when the Majority Report was just you.
Let's change the subject.
Rangers and Knicks are doing great.
Now shut up. Don't want people saying reckless things on your program.
That's one of the most difficult parts about this show.
This is a pro-killing podcast.
I'm thinking maybe it's time we bury the hatchet.
Left is best. Trump. Violet.
Twerk.
Don't be foolish and don't fucking tweet at me and don't bitch. The way Emma has cucked all of these people. Love it.
That's where my heart is, so yeah. I wrote my honors thesis about it.
Oh, she wrote an honors thesis. I should hand the main mic to you now.
You are to the right of me on foreign policy.
We already fund Israel, dude. Are you against that?
That's a tougher question. I don't have an answer to.
Incredible theme song.
I Bumbler.
Emma Viglin, absolutely one of my favorite people. Actually, not just in the game, like period.
Fun half, we got Brandon Sutton. Brandon, what's going on? Oh, can you announce that interview?
Oh, yeah. No, it's fine. Yeah. So I will – well, the reason I was tardy to the stream, and I apologize to all of the listeners out there, is because I was finishing up a recording with Crystal Ball and Kyle Kalinske for the Crystal, Kyle, and Friends podcast. I was the friend this time, in case you were wondering. And
you were
so,
a Crystal
yeah,
or Kyle? They didn't bring you in to...
to sub. No, I didn't sub this time. I didn't like tag in to be Crystal or Kyle. Not that I would be able to replace them, but no, I was the friend this time. So if you want to check that out, that should be out tomorrow. I think it was a great conversation. We talked about the Pam Bondi hearings. We talked about the AI apocalypse. We covered a really wide range of topics.
That's awesome. I look forward to that. I just want to, like, Kyle Kalinske and Jessica Burbank also, this thing where wear sunglasses, like when Kyle was talking with Michael Knowles, it's kind of nice, actually, because David Griscom and I, we were talking about, and I think you cover this too, Brandon, on your show, the Kyle Kalinske versus Michael Knowles, Piers Morgan fight, where Kyle just called him a cuck over and over again, showing how I think you, the type of respect you should give these freaks. And David Griscom and I put our sunglasses on in sort of solidarity with Kyle about it, but it's actually kind of nice to not have your eyes darting all over the place. You can look at stuff. I don't know if I can have Griscom allow us to do it all the time, but it was a nice little addition.
It is nice. I mean, I have two monitors, so people act like I'm the shiftiest guy on the planet because no one's ever worked from two monitors before. So, like, he's always looking back and forth. It's like, okay, yeah, well, you know, I am literally looking back and forth. But
I have teleprompters set up. I'm looking at.
We watch a lot of Michael Knowles on my show because he's like the conspiracy guy over on the Daily Wire. I don't know if you've ever noticed this about his content, but he's the one who covers like the exorcisms and stuff like that.
Christian
conspiracies. I honestly, it wasn't until I started watching him that I would have thought that Matt Walsh was the dumbest person on the Daily Wire, but it's for sure Michael Knowles. But that might just be because I'm much more familiar with him now. He has a lot of really low frequency takes. He seems to not really get things very quickly.
Well, he was an actor.
Yeah, the entire time Brandon was talking about that, I was just thinking of the acting reel.
Yeah.
That if people haven't seen that and want to hate Michael Knowles, all you got, it's a one-stop shop. Just go to his acting reel from like 2013 or whatever that was.
Like, yeah, he has a lot of like theatrical, I think, face gestures. He really hams it up. He's like almost like you could almost imagine him like a bit character in a Judd Apatow movie. Like if they couldn't get Jason Sudeikis or whoever that guy who played like the fourth, you know, who's the one from The Hangover? Whoever one who like is from The Hangover who plays like the dentist in it. Yeah, Ed Helms. Like, he could almost be like an Ed Helms kind of character. Like if you subbed Ed Helms out in The Hangover with like Michael Knowles, you could kind of see that. But in terms of like actual insightful commentary, I don't think he really has it.
No, nor masculinity. I'll say that as a man. Like Michael Knowles. Like these guys
really?
Are the ones who are lecturing us about masculinity, Jordan Peterson and Michael Knowles.
Really? You don't think that it's like his segments where he tells you how definitely sexually attractive he finds Sydney Sweeney for sure, 100%? You don't find that to be super masculine and alpha?
Well, I insist her sexually attractive.
Like, I don't find that convincing? But I sure find it convincing.
Yeah.
I find it super convincing too.
Yeah. No further questions, Your Honor. Let's do some interesting stuff here. Let's start with the Epstein stuff. It's, you know, the big scandal of our time. I mean, in terms of implicating power and their nasty behavior, though, I would say maybe the starvation of Cuba that we covered in the first part of the show. It's all kind of related, actually.
It's a real pick'em.
But let's just focus on this mass influence peddling and underage sex trafficking thing. And as I say this, I'm realizing we're just getting demonetized. This is a show, folks, we need your support because every fun half of the past, like,
it happens every time you say it.
Yeah, every fun half. And you see, like, is it Voidzilla, that guy who does those good YouTube videos? Like, they'll all bleep out these words.
Coffeezilla.
They'll always bleep out these words. I'm not going to go bleep out. Listen to 3 hours and bleep it out. So we're just going to have to lose it. So you have to support themajorityreport.com. What, Brandon?
No, I think it's important. I know Americans are infantilized, and that's enforced in a lot of ways. And in the case of YouTube, it's in social media, sometimes enforced by you not being able to use certain words that speak plainly to like the way things are happening. And I do think that sometimes, you know, it's fine. It's not always to detriment of the conversation to use a sub word. But when you're talking about something with this seriousness, you know, bleeping maybe, but having to do like the unalive thing or like, oh, it's not like, you know, it's not porn, it's corn, or it's like grape. I think cheapens it because we should be able to have an adult conversation about a very adult topic and not have to, you know, devolve into referring to people's genitals as like diamonds and ting tings because we're not children. And that enforcement of that standard, it just enforces lack of accountability because if you can't talk about it, you certainly can't solve it.
100%. I mean, Brian and I had this conversation before the show, actually, and it's like you have to, and it's a bit easier to say from a position like Majority Report where it will be okay if we'd lose advertising revenue, but it's inappropriate consideration to be thinking about, oh, I need to in this horrific story, make sure I can monetize it. That's not, you know, our motivations here. So with that, let's start with AOC saying that Pam Bondi is implicated in a massive cover-up to protect a ring of pedophiles. And we got this here. Here's AOC on the steps of the on Capitol Hill here. Oh yeah, sorry about that. I'll give you a heads up. It's gonna be 5, 6, and 7 then after AOC's here. But I think I mean a number of Congress people have been really good on this, but like
yeah,
I kind of. I see, like, was it Rebecca Ballant?
Becca Ballant,
like
from Vermont.
There's a sense of urgency that I appreciate from some of these folks, and a sense of like palpable fear that these victims are going to be failed by this system. That they're, I think, Bondi and Trump. First of all, with Pam Bondi, like did not pursue a pursue Epstein when she was AG of Florida. There were victims groups that wanted that reopened because it was very clear that when Alex Acosta, Trump's labor secretary in term one, gave Epstein a sweetheart deal, that that should be looked back into. And Pam Bondi didn't. And Pam Bondi is the attorney general now for Donald Trump, not in spite of that, but because of it, because that's on her resume. That she's covering this stuff up, and she is covering it up. Make no mistake about that. So here is, if we're ready, this clip, AOC on steps of Capitol Hill.
I think that we all saw today the performance that she had. She was screaming, thrashing, and I think it is because she knows that she is implicated in a massive cover-up to protect a powerful ring of pedophiles through the redactions of the names of perpetrators, the holding of 3 million files, the moving of the unexplained moving of Ghislaine Maxwell into a new cushy facility. All of these things are what she personally oversaw, and that's before even digging into whatever questions may arise from her history in Florida. And I think that her thrashing and her very erratic performance today pointed to the fact that there are real questions that point to the DOJ under her leadership and her leadership specifically, as well as her role in all of this.
Thank you.
I think that Merrick Garland we all saw
about Epstein not oops. Once when hit he was on this. And
yep, good. All good. So yeah, good on AOC. And let's just get a taste of that sort of lashing out, because I've seen it described by other places if she like blasts Democrats.
is that how they're describing it? Is that what they're saying happened?
Let me look at. Yes. Oh my God. Yeah, I think The Guardian had a headline like that. I'll look at exactly what their headline is after we play this clip of here's Pam Bondi with Becca Ballant. I mean, this is a sort of reduction ad absurdum of a lot of the pathologies of our politics here.
Didn't ask Merrick Garland anything about Epstein, not once when he was...
Weak sauce.
And
weak sauce.
Also, I want the record to reflect that, you know, with this anti-Semitic culture right now, she voted against a resolution condemning...
Oh,
he
is Jewish. Oh,
I just want to be clear.
Oh, do you want to go there, Attorney General? Or do you want to go there? Are you serious?
To the gentleman
talking
from
about
South
anti-Semitism
Carolina,
to a woman who lost her grandfather in the Holocaust?
My time.
Really?
The committee will be in order. Time.
Talk to Jared Wise about anti-Semitism.
The ranking member knows that.
I'm gonna. Can I get like 30 seconds back? You know.
Yeah, since, I've been.
Ballant took I think 30 the whole.
This
that wasn't even the worst. Yeah. That wasn't even the worst of it. It was a real clown show. Honestly, I knew that Robert Ringworth would say that, like, she blasts Democrats. Not only did she come across as incredibly unhinged, and not even the normal way they come across. This was almost like full, like, Karen maxing, like the final form of Karen. Like, I said on my own show, like, those body cam videos that you see on those police channels sometimes where it's like drunk Karen thrown out of country club and arrested for punching service staff. Like, that's what it felt like watching Pam Bondi do this. And even more than that, it was incredibly uncontrollable. convincing. It was incredibly performative, and it just raised more questions. It was even more suspicious because she didn't have any answers to the questions. When they would bring up like an email that would say something like "love the torture video," they would go like, "What did you do to like investigate this torture video?" And she would just start yelling about something. She would start yelling about the Dow Jones or start yelling about Trump derangement syndrome. Yeah. It was like, look at my lawyer, dog. Look at my lawyer, dog. If it weren't for the fact that I'm the president, I would be going to jail.
The Dow Jones thing, we played that yesterday. That was an insane clip. And I put in tech production another clip here that we'll get to in a second there. But I do want to circle in on what AOC said about the unexplained treatment that Ghislaine Maxwell has been given and the unaccountability of that. Here's a clip here, and let's see where I think we'll start with Jim Jordan here. But this is from go about a minute into this, Brian. And this is let me see who this congressperson was here. This is Deborah Ross, Democrat from North Carolina, questioning AG Bondi on the Judiciary Committee about this specifically this treatment that Maxwell's been given. And I'll say Brandon's point is exactly right. This was not impressive. And the headline that the Guardian put was that she taunts Democrats. And again, that framing is horrible. Yes, but here's Ross.
In prison. In July, she had a two-day interview with your deputy and President Trump's former defense attorney, Todd Blanche. Just days after that, Maxwell was transferred from a federal correctional institution in Florida to a minimum security camp in Texas, which she, as a sex offender, would normally be ineligible for. At this new facility, as the ranking member talked about, and by the way, it's nicknamed Club Fed, we've heard reports that she's been afforded special privileges. Puppy time, private workouts, personal mail, secretarial services. Attorney General Bondi, does a convicted sex offender like Ghislaine Maxwell deserve special treatment and prison and privileges in prison? Yes or no?
Let me be crystal clear on this. No.
And thank you.
Let me keep going.
Perfect. Well, I
did not know she was being transferred.
I asked you yesterday.
She was not transferred to a lower level.
Mr. Chairman, please stop the clock and remind the witness of the rules. One rule she needs to understand here.
And I'm glad that we're agreeing. So when we're agreeing, we can move on to some other things. But I want you to know that every time she does get these perks, and it's been publicly reported, that her... the folks she's abused, the survivors who are sitting here.
Pause it 1 second here. Just 2 points of fact. The Attorney General of the United States has direct supervision of the Bureau of Prisons. So this whole thing of, the Bureau of Prisons did it. You're the boss. The buck stops with you, Pam. Let's let it play a little bit further.
Reported that the folks she's abused, the survivors who are sitting here, they see themselves as being denied justice. They feel re-traumatized. And I'm glad that we agree on that. But she should not be in that prison. And she needs to be moved back to a maximum security prison as soon as possible. But what she has told another committee here is that she won't cooperate with them unless she gets clemency from Donald Trump. It's just crazy to consider that she can be wielding this kind of influence within the administration. But that begs the question, who ordered her to be transferred to the minimum security prison that she was ineligible for? Who signed off on the special privileges? Was it Mr. Blanche? Was it one of your other subordinates? So please, can you tell us who sent her there, since you don't agree she should be there?
I said I do not agree she should receive special treatment. She was transferred, I learned after the fact, to the same level facility.
No.
And that is a question
for
the Bureau of Prisons. I was not involved in that at all.
That's the other the point of fact I wanted to make is there's no question that she got moved to a nicer place. There's no question. And this, she gives it away by saying, I didn't know anything about it, but it's also not a problem, which is sort of like what Pete Hegseth was doing with the double tap in the Caribbean. Like, look, I wasn't there. I wasn't in the room. I'm a busy guy.
I support my generals, though.
Yeah, but they did the right thing that I didn't tell them to do.
Yeah. And it was all after, like they said, she met with Todd Blanche, Trump's own personal lawyer, which is also something that, Pam Bondi was too, right? These are both this investigation is being spearheaded by two of Trump's personal lawyers, which is another incredibly suspicious and, you know, biasing thing.
Two people from Florida. Or at least in Acosta and Bondi, I just keep pointing that out. I know Acosta wasn't AG, he was Department of Labor. Two people who were in the justice system in Florida that let this guy skate. And we're supposed to act surprised. We're supposed to reserve judgment about what is blatantly a cover-up. You talk about the access to the unredacted files. By the way, we don't have Ghislaine Maxwell's emails. Those could be released. The access to those files that is released, if Rokana or Massey wants to go look at the unredacted files, they will be using up half of the computers that have been allotted to look it up because there's only fucking four of them.
Well, that's the important thing, Matt, because I think we should linger on that point for 1 second. It is a cover-up. And now, since there has been an Epstein Transparency Act, it's legally a cover-up because they are illegally refusing to release files, the files that they admit that they have, not to mention the files that we don't know if they have or whatever they were scrubbing when Trump assigned tens of thousands of FBI agents to the files in March. Whatever that happened, they are being open that they're not releasing the files in their totality, and they are illegally redacting people's names for reasons why they've been explicitly denied from. So it just is a cover-up. People don't want to, you know, say that. People don't want to admit that because it implies that every element of what people imagine the cover-up is doing is also true. But it is for sure a cover-up. Like we have, it was a cover-up before as well, but now it's just, it should be legally prosecutable as a cover-up. They should be holding Pam Bondi in contempt for like lying to Ted Lieu in front of Congress, for like not releasing the files, but they won't do that. And so it still exists in the realm of like, well, I guess, you know, you could kind of call it a cover-up, but it's for sure legally one now.
Yeah, I mean, you're seeing like Lindsey Graham, I believe, has made a statement like, well, if anything was actually in there, we'd have prosecuted people, which I believe is fairly similar to what Ezra Klein was saying. I'll be honest, that's not what I'm seeing in these files. I'm seeing serious accusations about extremely powerful people that the FBI didn't want to look into because it's fucking hard to look after, to look into extremely powerful pedophiles. And they would rather, I don't know, spy on a fucking mosque.
But no, that's a great point. You know, cause if that's your position, if your position is that, like, well, I will say that's a different position from what we heard before, which is that there was no evidence. Now we see that there is evidence. But if the new retreat position is that, okay, there might be evidence, but we got rid of that. We myth-busted. We saw these really sketchy emails, which are objectively really sketchy, although there might be completely plausible, innocuous, and real explanations for why they're not sketchy. So we looked into them, and we found that they were actually all fine, all above board. Why don't they say that? Why don't they say what that investigation looked like? How did you look into them? Like, you know, when Ted Lieu was questioning her about the mounting of Andrew over that, like, victim, which they redacted the face of, you know, she could have said, oh, yeah, we looked into that, and X, Y, and Z was what we found, and that is just an example of how we, you know, we were able to absolve these people of wrongdoing. But that has not been anything of what they said. They've been totally denying it, or they've been pretending like, you know, it's so unfair for you to even ask them to produce not evidence, but a record of the investigation. There doesn't seem like, based on everything that we've heard so far, even in these congressional hearings, it doesn't seem like there was a real investigation undertaken with the purposes of actually looking for indictable offenses. I can't say that there was no investigation taking place. I can't say that they didn't look into it at all. All I can say is that they have not been able to account for, like, okay, there's this email talking about a torture video. There's this email listing out names, which could be like human trafficking victims. Like, you know, there are all these victims who want to speak to you. There's this witness who said he was driving for Trump. Can you explain what happened when you talked to them, when you looked into this? No, we can't do that because we didn't. And so, like, from the outside standpoint, from the outside observer, it doesn't seem like if there was an investigation, they can tell us anything about it, or that there was none at all.
Akash Patel's statement that there was no evidence, that's like, I mean, perjury.
At the least.
Like, I mean, if he qualified it with evidence that required the, or like prompted the FBI to investigate, that would be at least like some wiggle room. It would be ludicrous because, again, these emails are disgusting. The reference and definitely deserve investigation.
They're not even indicting the Democrats that they're using as deflections.
Right.
Like, Pam Bondi keeps bringing up Reid Hoffman. Arrest him.
Yeah.
If you want to deflect with Reid Hoffman, nobody would mind that.
And their deflection is, well, Merrick Garland didn't do anything about it. Like, you're just doing what Merrick Garland did, in your opinion. Yeah. And that's exculpatory for you? That's a whole other question, is why the Democrats didn't go into this stuff. I mean, it's worth pointing out that, and people will point out the bipartisan nature. I think it's important that Thomas Massie is playing the role he is. But, I mean, it is the Democrat side that has been compelling the release of this stuff. I also think, like, Ro Khanna, I don't like the venture capitalists in his orbit. But I do appreciate the work he's been doing on this. And I think if the victims do, that's kind of the most important thing. And, these are people that exist that are going to D.C. to sit in these testimonies, to stand up and say, I have made allegations either myself or through lawyers, and I have not been asked by Akash Patel, who went in indignantly to our elected representatives on a fucking committee, this guy who was put there by Donald Trump, who was a podcaster a few years ago, to say there was no evidence at all in the files, in these millions of files. And these women have to go there and say, I wasn't allowed to testify about what happened to me as a child. They didn't ask. They're not curious, because they're not. They are. This is what we are seeing is a blatant cover up. There is no wiggle room from that. It's what's happening in front of our eyes right now. And it is kind of frustrating.
I mean, did you see, this is obviously a side thing, but it's, I guess, in all this bad news, something that's kind of funny and could get joy out of is that Status Newsletter, which like covers like the media and everything, they reported that different news outlets were comparing notes. And apparently Pam Bondi has this thing she does.
Yes.
Where when she's contacted about a story for a statement and she doesn't want the story published, she begins to cry to the reporter, waterworks and everything. And they had contacted other outlets and talked to other reporters who've covered things involving her. And they all say that this is a thing she does, that she cries on the phone, begging them not to publish whatever it is they're going to publish. Just a fun little side thing about this person.
I believe it. Do you think she's better at fake crying than Erica Kirk, or do you think she's like worse at it? I think she's probably better at it, but not because she's good, but because like Erica's bad.
She has more experience, I guess, doing it on a stage, right? Erica Kirk has just been thrusted into the spotlight after being sort of a background character for a long time. She hasn't had the experience.
And I mentioned Thomas Massie. Let's get to this here from Massie. Who is talking? The Lutnick angle of this is—it's bizarre, because Lutnick would not be in; he'd be in hot water, because I mean he was Epstein's neighbor, and went to his island. But the thing where he went out ahead of it last summer to say, "Oh yeah, that guy's blackmailing everyone," I actually stopped any contact with him years before I went to his island with my family, is such a blatant lie that even Republicans are embarrassed by it, which is, I mean, says an awful lot. But here's Massie talking about that.
Republican Congressman from Kentucky, Thomas Massie, is back here with me tonight. And thank you, sir, for being back here. I believe you went back to the Justice Department today. If you did, what more can you tell us about what you saw?
Well, I saw that Lutnick shared his phone number with Epstein, and that their assistants were setting up phone calls between them. So there is at least that other connection. I didn't find any new names today. I didn't have a lot of time to spend there. But the main, by the way, it's a room with four computers, and it's busy all the time. There's always at least four congressmen in there. And the main complaint that I hear as we search through these files is that when you unredact some of the files, you encounter more redactions. And then when we ask the DOJ, why are these files redacted? Why can't we remove the redactions? The DOJ says, well, that's the form in which we received the files. Now, here's the problem with that, Caitlin. The legislation that Ro Khanna and I wrote directs the Attorney General to produce the documents, but they have to give all the documents that are in the possession, not of the DOJ, but also of the FBI and also of the U.S. attorneys. So what's happened, it seems, is that the U.S. attorneys and or the FBI have redacted documents, given them to the DOJ, and then the DOJ hasn't done their diligence to go get the original documents.
But the whole point of letting lawmakers go into that room is that you're supposed to be able to...
Yeah, you're supposed to be able to see what isn't available to everybody else. It's not available to even them. It's all simulated. It's all being slowly trickled out. In a way that like is maximally protective to somebody, to people who absolutely do not should not be protected right now. I don't know how much more I have to say about that. I'm curious if you guys have anything more before I move on.
Well, I mean, I think the point that you made about Lutnick is such a powerful one, because I think it's something that we just keep seeing be reinforced by the Epstein files, which is that at the very least, it was impossible to hang out with this guy even casually at his place of residence, at his office, at his island, which I don't know how you could casually hang out at someone's island without noticing, or at least should have having reasonably noticed that something was up. If you want to be someone that we should trust to be a steward of our government, whether it's the Commerce Secretary or the Attorney General or the President, if you were able to hang out around Jeffrey Epstein, you should have noticed that something was up at the very least, even if you didn't engage in anything. And that's what Howard Lutnick said. He said, my wife and I met him at his apartment. And within like the first few minutes, he was, you know, all up in my face saying how much he loves like sensual massages. And I was like, this guy's a creep. We should never hang out with him again. And then what we found out in the files is that not only did he hang out with him again, he took his kids, all four of his kids, with him and his wife to Epstein's private island after Epstein was already convicted and on the sex offender registry. And so I'm inclined to believe him when he said that he met Epstein the first time and he knew something was up, and not think that he's revising that. It just didn't matter to him. And he was still willing to engage with him. Whether or not he was up to anything no good with Epstein beyond like, you know, what we know, I can't say. But it does seem hard to believe by his own admission that he couldn't have been suspicious about something else being up. Now, he might not have looked into that, but I think that just goes back to further reinforcing this idea that this is an issue not just of Epstein specifically, but of a certain class of people in our society, the billionaire, moneyed, you know, well-established, well-entrenched elites who not only are preying on people monetarily, financially with the system that they've constructed, but apparently that's not enough for them. They're also like physically preying on them in ways that we hadn't even considered, except for in the most like, I think, you know, conspiratorial sections of the internet. And they really just have not a semblance of an answer for it, which I think really speaks to how unaccountable they've been to this point, because they don't even know how to begin to answer it. Their whole lie, the deception so far has been so poor. It's been so poor.
People say
Do you see the most recent thing I put in tech chat there? Just a short clip of Lutnick. But I don't know if you guys saw the way he breaks out into laughter when this is brought up. It seems like extremely incriminating. Here's him being asked in the Oval Office. Not him. He's seeing Trump be asked about this Epstein stuff. And look at this sort of loss of control of his body. This is beyond just a normal laugh. This is, I think, an extreme amount of nervous energy and anxiety releasing itself cathartically through laughter. And it seems, I think, grotesque here as a Howard Lutnick.
He's hosting some kind of gathering of top advisors this evening to talk about how to respond to the Epstein situation.
I don't know. I could ask you that question. I don't know of it, but I...
Like, that is weird, right?
That's very weird.
No.
It reminds you when the father in Twin Peaks is possessed by Bob. And he just can't stop laughing as he murders.
No, I think it's weird. I think in that case, it's like nervous laughter. But I do think, you know, at the very core of it, they've been laughing at us this entire time. I think that, you know, leftists have always known that, especially when we see that, you know, the billionaire class roll out their wealth in front of people and, like, you know, the hustle cucks online, like, simp for them. We've always known that they've been laughing at us. But I think that with the Epstein situation, we really get a sense of just how much they've been laughing at us, how much they've been preying on us, and behind the scenes just been, you know, engaging in, like, the most depraved of behavior while, like, engaging in the most moralistic of tone policing at the highest levels. Like, we're the job creators. We're the ones who know what's best for society. Like, oh, you don't want to work overtime unpaid? Well, you should just maybe work as hard as Elon Musk or Donald Trump. They've been laughing at people the whole time. In ways that people hadn't even considered. And I think, I mean, they're not laughing as much now. Howard Lutnick certainly didn't seem like he was laughing when he was being grilled in front of the Senate. But, you know, I think for decades they had been able to laugh at people without even, like, you know, without even imagining that they would ever be held accountable for it.
The way that and Emma talked about this a little bit with when we had Brace on, Belden on from TrueAnon. But the way that they've been manipulating all this stuff from QAnon to Bitcoin, and it, when I say that, I mean, like, Jeffrey Epstein himself, and sort of even, like, the QAnon stuff of, like, using the code words, and you see weird code in these emails, and it's just it is crazy how much this stuff has sort of, like, come full circle, and just sort of been like to have one figure that is associated both with Peter Thiel, Elon Musk, Larry Summers, the guy from Poll and 4chan, and Bitcoin folks, like,
a moot.
Yeah, like, that is quite a social circle. And that's before you get to, like, Nick DiPaolo showing up for dinners and seeing wild stuff that he has to reflect on later. Go ahead, Brent.
He was a power broker. And, you know, at the end of the day, it is a lot of people. It's so many people. And he was in so many rooms that it makes you wonder who was putting him there. Right. Mm-hmm. Makes you wonder who was putting him in contact with these people, because certainly another thing that becomes, I think, very hard to believe when you read these interactions from behind the scene is that, like, he was just some sort of genius, sophisticated money mover, some genius, sophisticated, like, business planner. I don't see a lot of that on display in these emails. And not only in the sense that, like, it wouldn't be easy to, like, pretend like nothing is going on with him because we've seen his emails, but, you know, also just in, like, the sense that, like, it just, you know, ultimately seems like he was kind of like a dumbass. Like, that the way in which he was, like, sophisticated in his thinking is the same kind of stupid stuff you hear from, like, Elon Musk or, like, Curtis Yarvin or those types that, like, maybe works to fool people at, like, a dinner party, but not enough to, like, trust this person with all of your money the way that they were talking about. And so it does raise the question of, like, okay, but, you know, what was really happening that, like, no one seemed to notice, or he was able to get into the White House? Because it's certainly not what we were being told. And I think that's, like, again, like, that's on full display when you look at, like, what's being said. And when to speak to, like, the code words, I mean, that's just in the stuff that we have. And we have to understand this is, like, strategic transparency. And so some of this stuff is, like, what I would put up to the same, you know, Bohemian Grove kind of scenario, where it's like, yeah, I have no doubt that when they're laughing at people, they love to speak in code sometimes because it's fun, right? Like, you know, it's fun to speak in code. And he was a weirdo, like the Riddler or something. But I have to imagine that a lot of the emails that we're not seeing, a lot of the really heavy redactions are not in code, because there are plenty of, like, and that's what they're trying to pretend, like, oh, everything is so coded and nuanced and subtle that who would know what's going up. Half of the emails are just like, did you like the torture video? You sure did.
Yeah,
I sure love 7 and 8 year olds. And it's like, there's not so much subterfuge. That's the illusion that they've been trying to gaslight people into thinking for, like, why there's been no real evidence or investigation, because this could mean anything. It's like, it couldn't mean anything, come on.
Right. Yeah, there's not a lot of brilliance on display in those emails. The idea that they're speaking in code when they're just clearly being outright, like the example you just gave, Brandon, with what they were talking about, is just, this doesn't make any sense. I'm sorry. And in terms of, like, why Epstein was always invited, was he some sort of visionary, or he comes, like, again, you said he comes off like a dumbass. And not only he comes off like a dumbass, everyone he's talking to in there comes off like a dumbass. Like, there are so many emails that, like, are
Noam Chomsky.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, you're reading through them and it's like, This is how these people talk amongst each other. Like, it's not even like people give them too much credit of being like some sort of like rich, evil, like billionaire pulling the strings behind the scenes or whatever. I mean, these guys are clearly using their power, but they're not doing it very secretly or smartly or in any way that like you were like, there's the average person who, in terms of intelligence factor or whatever, but extremely evil, and they have the monetary means to carry out whatever horrible things they want to do.
The Kimball Musk stuff is, I think, fascinating to me because he gets divorced, and all of a sudden an email where he's like, I'm divorced, I can live my life, gets forwarded to Jeffrey Epstein. And it's like by Boris Nikolic, who was another guy who was like, I think, go between Epstein and Bill Gates, if memory serves. I think he's basically just one of Epstein's sort of social planners. That's very revealing to me that, okay, I mean, it's like I don't know. It's like, oh, he's back on psychedelics, and somebody alert the dealer. You know, that's and why would Epstein be the guy? Well, part of that when you help rich people elicit anything illegally is you get the information that you've done that, and that is its own sort of leverage.
I remember when I break up with a relationship, I always go looking for someone to invest monetary funds in me. So that's probably what he was doing, right? Oh, you broke up with your wife. Okay, Epstein is interested in investing in whatever project you have. Yeah, come on. We know exactly why they were sending Kimball over there. Musk, his own email asking when the wildest party on your island will be.
When is the wildest party?
What do you mean by wild?
He meant playing Dungeons and Dragons. Yeah, he meant they were going to be playing Dungeons and Dragons 3.5 edition. No, I'm sorry, 4th edition. That's what he meant by wild. They're not. They're playing like 4th edition. That's the wildest he can experience. No, I mean, it's to Matt's point. I think the thing that comes to mind is that I have no doubt that Jeffrey Epstein was in possession of very valuable information. I have no doubt that he was in possession of things that people would want within that world. The thing that I have doubt of is that he would be able to access and get them without like significant help from state or non-state actors. It just doesn't seem like that's the case based on those emails. The more stuff that comes out, the more stuff you have to just wonder like what they're hiding. And they tell you that they're hiding it all the time. They tell you that they like allocated every FBI agent to look for Trump's name. It's like, and people go like, what could that mean? It's like, what do you mean?
I mean, and that's the other thing is Pam Bondi got really or maybe it was Kash Patel, but really upset at the idea that the FBI's priorities are wrong. The entire investigative apparatus of the United States, from the FBI to ICE and DHS, is preoccupied with the sort of agenda of Klansmen and Nazis right now, and they've taken people off of these sorts of major investigations, and that's because they work for them now. Like,
you mean pro-Nazi? They're pro.
Right, exactly. not the anti-Nazi, anti-Klan agenda. Let me be clear. It's run by Klansmen now, and they're not interested in Nazis, and they're not interested actually in going after elite pedophiles. They're interested in, is there anything we can use to get that fry cook who's Guatemalan out of this country? Like, that's the priorities of the FBI right now.
I mean, they can't even prioritize finding people who have hurt their own inner circle. I mean, think about the guy who allegedly shot Charlie Kirk practically escaped if it wasn't for his own family convincing him to turn himself in. They had no clue who the hell killed Charlie Kirk or allegedly killed Charlie Kirk. They can't even muster up the ability to help their own because they're that incompetent and stupid. And on top of that, their priorities are completely wrong as well.
And you know, go ahead, Brennan.
There you go.
You know, during the Biden administration, you had all these folks like Steven Crowder, et cetera, who were saying we need to abolish the FBI because they went after Jan Sixers. The Democrats, and I know how quixotic this sounds, The Democrats need to go after these agencies and reshape them into way, because they've always, because even before this, they've always been shaped towards as a spear against the left. And this was before Trump. What was the FBI doing? It was sending people undercover into mosques in large numbers and entrapping people in terror plots. And before that, COINTELPRO. I mean, and also let's not skip over all of the anti-war surveillance it did during Bush administration. And before that, it was COINTELPRO, which was denied. We would not know. Everyone knows, like, oh, it's a common thing that we know that the FBI surveils folks. People should read Betty Metzger's book, The Burglary, which is about the Media Pennsylvania burglary in 71 or 72. Prior to that, the idea that the FBI was spending a significant fraction of its time and effort, not after going after bad guys, but going after the left and infiltrating anti-war groups, was thought of as a conspiracy theory, the same way a lot of the Jeffrey Epstein stuff was thought of as a conspiracy. And it turned out that actually it was extremely true, that a huge portion of the money that we give to FBI agents is for them to send informants into the broader left, including, I mean, most famously, the assassination of Fred Hampton in Chicago. But that just cut and pasted across communities in this country over and over again. It needs to be addressed. It needs, like, this stuff, we need to have, and the problem right now, I think, to go really, like, 40,000-foot view, is that Democrats don't have a vision for the world they want to create. They have a vision about the past, which is that, oh, we're the party of civil rights, and we're the party of the New Deal, and give us credit for that stuff that happened a long time ago. What world do they actually want to create? When the Democrats were convinced by massive amounts of protest and action to support those things, they were also buying into a vision for the world. What's the vision that is being sold by standard, like, Chuck Schumer-style Democrats now? There's and the problem is the right's vision is insanely utopian and impractical. They're never going to be able to make this a white country. It's America's too diverse. You're going to need a budget way bigger than the one you gave ICE, and people just aren't going to tolerate it. But it at least is a vision, and that you can put resources towards a vision, even if it's a stupid one. And the Democrats need to develop, like, what is the world that we want to create here? Because it's broader than just the immigration conversation. The anti-immigrant sentiment has only become so salient because there's nothing else going on for people. Like, I don't think America's got more racist than it was in the 1960s or 1970s. I think this stuff's become salient when people's jobs are pinched. But I'm curious if you guys have any response to that.
Well, you know, I agree with your point. I think that the racist demagoguery that is, you know, very popular now is being facilitated by people's waning material conditions, what they experience now. But I think when it comes to what the Democrats have as a vision, I think, you know, what we would consider it to just be like managed fascism, managed authoritarianism, yeah. Like fascism stewarded by a more reasonable, like, you know, technocrat. They wouldn't call it that, right? They would just call it like whatever version of neoliberal like doctrine they're subscribed to today, third way Democrat, responsible, blah, 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 abundance. They would call it that. But at its core, it's the belief that our society works best when there are people who exist at the fringes who are like heavily, heavily impoverished, because that's the only way our society is able to have the uber wealthy. It's one of the only ways our society can have the uber wealthy. So the Democrats' view is not that these things are bad. It's just that they're being led by bad people. They might want to police the extremes, but that really is only in the sense that they want to police the extreme uses of these particular infrastructure. They want to be able to subject people to the oppressive boot of the state. They just have a different view on who those people should be. And they're able to sell that view by, like, you know, abstracting it, by pushing it onto populations in the global South, by, you know, like giving a mealy mouth response to like responses from Republicans. So I think it's just that as part of their managed view of the way society could be run, they just include the Republicans in that way. They include Republicans as part of their like managed fascist view for society as their kind of foil that makes them look the best. Republicans just don't view the Democrats the same way. They don't view the Democrats as like an acceptable foil for their political ambitions, a necessary one. They want them gone and it to be a one-party system where they rule consistently. And that's what Trump is building right now with his, like, you know, DOJ going into like individual states to demand the voting rolls. And maybe Trump won't use that current, you know, in his administration to steal elections and make them more fraudulent than they already are in some places. But maybe the next Republican will, because they've been building an election machine, an election stealing machine themselves for decades. Yep. And they become very efficient at it. And so if Trump is able to effectively expand that, then they will definitely use it in the future.
100%.
Right. I think that's a great point. I mean, I feel like you're not even like analyzing it in a way that needs analyzation. Like the members of each party have been outright and open about how each of them views the other party. I mean, I'll never forget Nancy Pelosi's infamous, "We want a strong old style Republican party." And it's like, no. So, I mean, exactly what you said, Brandon.
Yeah. Let's get to, speaking of those old fashioned Democrats, Bill Maher had Adam Carolla on Club Random.
Man Show reboot.
Ziggy Zoggy, Ziggy Zoggy. Oi, oi, oi. Remember that?
Wow, I don't. Unfortunately, I do.
Yeah.
I do too.
How old were Jimmy Kimmel and Adam Carolla when they had a show where they ended it with young women jumping on trampolines?
Well, yeah.
I'll tell you how old I was when I watched it, like 13 or 14. And that was the best show in the world. So awesome. I don't know if you should be called the man, but I eventually grew out of it at like 15.
The 15-year-old show, the 15-year-old boy show, yeah.
When the show ended, Adam Carolla was either 39 or 40 years old, based on his age.
Man.
According to the leaked GOP texts, he's a young man. He was a young Republican.
Well, no, I appreciate that as a 37-year-old. But I'll say it's been a while since I would feel comfortable putting my face next to, here's some young models we have jumping on trampolines. But, you know, times change. Speaking of times changing, here's Bill Maher talking with Adam Carolla. And they have an interesting thing to say about, you know, where all this politics has gone.
Time. Oh, you're, you know, Republican and right leaning. I go, listen, I don't own a gun. I'm not religious at all. I'm for abortion and pot smoking and everything. How right can
that,
I be?
You've put your finger on the thing that makes me so incensed about the woke and the far left, which is this, that they want to characterize people, you, me, Barry Weiss, you know, Lesbian and Jewish, and like, things that used to like be our...
Isn't the thing that finally like destroyed Adam Carolla in the mainstream entirely that weird live stream he did where he was following around like a black woman or a black couple and saying insanely racist things to them? What was that?
That was Anthony Cumia.
Oh, I'm thinking Opie of the wrong guy. Okay, my bad. Yeah.
A different Adam C.
I got confused.
I could see why.
It's
racist.
I don't know. Like, is it just me or does right-wing media seem especially whiny recently? I don't know if it's because the Epstein files have come out. I don't know if it's because they feel like they're on the back foot because a lot of the people who like were kind of working with them, like a lot of the more maybe just politically agnostic alpha bro podcasters were kind of on their side. So they felt cool for a little bit. They felt cool when that, like what Andrew Schultz guy was like, you know, bigging them up. They felt cool when they had some like actual real comedians for the first time on their side. And, you know, not that they've been almost fully abandoned by those people because of what Trump has been doing with Epstein and with the ICE stuff. They're kind of just, they're really leaning into the poor me bullshit again. They're really leaning into the boo hoo, boo, it's so hard to be an older white man who's a millionaire stuff. It's honestly, I find it to be unattractive, but I know like their right wing audience like loves this shit. They lap it up. They can't help but just like slurp this stuff up. They love their slurp juice.
Well, they're having like victim withdrawal because they are in power in every single facet of this government.
Yeah, that's a weird thing. Is like it's the J.D. Vanceification, but it is really intolerable when they are in power and it's all the whining. Let's play a little bit more of this.
Me, Barry Weiss.
Oh, sorry.
You know, that's who's a lesbian positive. And
go back about 10 seconds. If I scripted this for us to like tee off on, right. I could not have inserted a better name. The idea that Barry Weiss is not a conservative is something that could only be said by a rabid Zionist reactionary like Bill Maher, and that's what he is. Yeah, go ahead, Brandon.
It's because ultimately, even though they consider themselves whatever they consider themselves, they still believe in neoliberal identity politics. They still believe that if you just belong to a certain group or if you don't belong to a certain group, which we like, you know, very often code being racist or right wing or visibly right wing as being something that, you know, hillbillies are like low class, like poor Southerners are, even though we know a lot of billionaires vote Republican. Like they just think that if you happen to have the right identity check marks, you just that tells you what politics you are. Like, oh, you're a lesbian, you must be like a communist. But that's just like that's superficial, obviously.
That's literally where he goes with this.
About the woke and the far left, which is this, that they want to characterize people. You, me, Barry Weiss, you know, who's a lesbian and Jewish. And things that used to like be our... we need no further credentials
right.
to let you know that we are certainly not conservatives. We're not right-wingers. We're not whatever you think... And yet it's never enough for them.
Right.
It's never enough that we're just not willing to go along with your insanity. That doesn't make us conservatives.
How about if you testify in front of look, I know Adam Carolla says he really like cares about abortion. I guess we'll take that at face value as he goes to testify for Republicans about how like bad wokeness and free speech is. I mean, outrageous. Let's a little bit further here before we play a little bit of old Bill Maher before, like, so we can talk about how much of a principled liberal leftist he is.
Right. No, I agree. Barry's great, and there's many people that way. And again, it's interesting because they feel compelled to put you somewhere, and if you don't conform and it doesn't work, they have an issue with it. But I think, well, first off, here's the thing. Imagine if you had to conform. I mean, imagine if COVID came around and you just had to go in.
I did.
All in on all of it.
I did have to conform. I didn't want the vaccine at all. Not that I'm against all vaccines.
Okay, whatever.
I
enough of this bullshit. I needed that.
I can't believe these guys are still so hung up on COVID in terms of.
It's the first time any of these guys were told to do something against their will, maybe ever in their lives.
But they didn't. They didn't even have to do it. They just couldn't partake in certain things. If they didn't, but nothing that was mandatory. It wasn't like you can't eat or sleep or live in your home.
Right.
Like,
I don't say that.
You could have done whatever you wanted except partake in certain things that were saying we can't have you here. We don't want you here if you're not vaccinated. These guys are just so ridiculous. I mean, I also love the identity politics thing when they're literally doing identity politics. Like, we believe in abortions and
I'm not a gun owner. So
we have to be liberal. I mean, that's our identity when
you're Jewish.
I gotta be honest. I know we say this all the time, and we're definitely biased, but like being a conservative seems incredibly embarrassing because they're always running away from it. Conservatives, the conservatives are always running away from being conservative, from identifying as conservative, from like owning it. You don't see this from people on the left. You know, you don't see this from people, and even conservatives want to imagine that they're on the left. And so I just feel like they should, you know, either adopt our positions or shut up, because clearly like they're too embarrassed to be seen like on the right. And I understand that, but there's so much denialism, there's so much projection. And I know some of that is because of the propaganda that gets associated with like the right left spectrum. But it seems so like hard to be like, you know, involved in this kind of space with the go ahead.
I mean, another thing strengthen that point too is look what they're spending the time talking about. They're not talking about the things they believe that make them clash with the other liberals, that make those liberals say they aren't liberal. They're talking about the things that they believe make them liberal, that they're in agreement of. Why don't you guys talk about the specifics or even touch upon one thing that you disagree with liberals about? And I think that tells you everything you need to know, because it takes the mask right off, right?
The only thing that they can say that they makes them like significantly left is that essentially they like smoking weed. Because whenever someone like says like, "Oh, I'm a leftist because like of weed," they just mean they like smoking it and they want to make it as easy as possible. And the abortion thing, if it's not rooted in any particular like, you know, personal story they have with impregnating perhaps a too young lady and needing an abortion, it's just a situation of like, I don't care. Like, I'm not a woman, so I don't care. That doesn't make you, in my opinion, politically left, because I do care. Like, I do care if women are allowed to get abortions. I do think that it should happen. Like, so the position of like, I'm a liberal, I just don't care what happens to women or if gay people get married. Some people get by on that because the bar is so low in America. But I know that does distinguish you from, I think, people who are reasonably considered like on the left, because you don't care. Like, you don't care if people have rights. You just only care about the things that affect you. And when you do care about those things, like, they tend to be conservative, right? Like you said, they're only willing to highlight the little bit of overlap that they have that are all rooted in like, well, I don't care about that issue, or I do because it personally impacts me. But the other things, it's so much distance.
It was entire sort of anti-vax bullshit from like the dumb idiot streamers up to like people like Vinay Prasad or Jay Bhattacharya of the Brownstone Institute, people who were given platforms on ostensibly leftist podcasts to talk about the overreach of pharma. I want to say that was all horseshit. That was all horseshit. Everyone that purveyed that should be ashamed of themselves. The people who hosted Vinay Prasad, who is now in power, who is now saying, oh, yeah, the FDA is done looking at new vaccines. The only thing that was scandalous about the vaccine policy in the United States of America wasn't that it was secretly killing people or causing people to die. It was that our government decided that it was enough, even though it didn't completely protect from adverse events. It was enough to compel people back into the workforce. Full stop. It is not deeper than that. Because the problem with the vaccines is that they weren't nationalized. Like, it's not that they were scary. And all this Jimmy Dore shit about how it's actually like causing all these adverse events. It was the largest vaccination campaign in like modern history. If there was actually these large amounts of adverse effects, we would hear more than just the dumbass VAERS shit that they constantly talk about. You would see a huge problem. You know what we actually do see is long-term effects from COVID it fucking self. Long-term effects that are worsened by people not getting the vaccine. And I can't stand that it's just not a part of my healthcare, that I can go in and get vaccinated for all this stuff all the time. I'm boosted. I think it was last fall. Maybe it was the fall before. But I am not ashamed to say that. And there's a certain type of like discourse around this that is like people say, like, you boosted? Yeah, motherfucker. Like, and this idea that the people who like didn't want to get the vaccine but still wanted to go to fucking Denny's or TGI Fridays, I'm sorry, stay the fuck home, order in. Like, you were not a fucking victim. And to have those people being like, oh, this ICE stuff gets you mad? Well, I was out on the government when they started checking people's papers to see if I was vaccinated. You're fucking babies. You're fucking stupid.
Oh, yeah.
And people have respected this stuff for way too long. And I think people should go back and find out if their favorite YouTuber had Vinay Prasad on or Jay Bhattacharya. Jay Bhattacharya, who at the beginning of COVID said the case against Medicare for all. Like, these are charlatans that exist as part of a conspiracy against empowering you over your health. And they were peddled by people as if they were some kind of libertarian against big pharma. They were not. They were charlatans. I got a little bit heated there.
No, that was perfect. I mean, you're absolutely correct. You're absolutely right.
They're almost in bad faith, I would say. Almost in bad faith. Anyway, go ahead, Bender.
I think the fact that these guys still, like so many of these people, still obsess over this, obsess over something that is now, it's going to be 6 years ago, and they're still obsessing over that time frame. And because they're obsessed over that time frame, they're affecting 6 years on medical advancements in not just the area of COVID and COVID prevention, but also every other illness as well, because this whole anti-COVID vaccine thing, because the government can't tell me what to do, has manifested into a full-blown, anti-vaxxers always existed, but they were always on the fringe.
Yep.
Now, because of the COVID vaccine, anti-vaccine sentiment across the board for all sorts of illnesses and diseases has become a mainstream thing that we have to deal with now. We see people across the country, different communities be ravaged by diseases that were obliterated just months or years ago. I should say, like, they didn't exist just months or years ago. They were obliterated many, many, many years ago thanks to the invention of those vaccines.
I mean, Claudia Sheinbaum is having to say, like, in addition to all the guns and drug problems, the demand in your country and supply of those things is causing. Also, you're giving us fucking measles. Like, that's how shabby this country is right now.
No, I mean, the response to, like, the, you know, the public health initiative, the, I would say, like, almost impressive at its scientific level, public health initiative by the CDC and associated scientists during COVID-19 was just, you know, overshadowed by the culture that it was received by. And in the United States, there are just certain things about our culture that made it very difficult for people to appreciate what was happening in a way that would result. And I think anything kind of but this, unless for, like, a radical transformation in people's imagination. And, you know, we're we're hyper individualistic. You know, people associate freedom in America with consumer culture. And so not being allowed to go and shop in person, not being allowed to eat inside your favorite restaurant, for some people did feel like a loss of their only freedom that they ever had. And even people who consider themselves, I think I remember people who consider themselves to be like leftists felt the same way, because it's like, that's all you have in America. If you don't have the ability to go to Target and pick between 17 different types of Cheerios, you don't have freedom. If you don't have the ability to like work 55 hours a week and then maybe on Friday afford to spend some of that money on a bar with your friends, you don't have anything in America. And I think the pandemic exposed that to a lot of people. And instead of, you know, really confronting that, a lot of people weren't able to confront that the way they should have. They retreated into this idea of like, it was like oppressive. It was like being in Nazi Germany. It was like the Holocaust, because I couldn't buy the things I wanted to in person. I couldn't go to Chili's. And, you know, I think it's just sad. It really speaks to the imagination of people in the United States that for them, that was the worst thing that they could possibly ever imagine. And they're talking about it 6 years later, not because millions of people died, but because they couldn't go to Chili's, because they couldn't go to the concert that they wanted. And people will try to dress it up. They'll go like, this is not about that. This is about rights. This is about like freedom. It's like, yeah, but for you, like those rights and freedoms are the ability to go to Chili's, right? And so we can agree that there is an abstract value to that, right? But what you're really concerned about is that you weren't able to go shopping and you weren't able to go to Chili's. Sometimes people go, I wasn't able to go to church. The fuck you weren't, bro. You weren't going to church. Like, you know, not consistently. That wasn't happening.
Also, they only think about their individual freedom. They're not thinking about the freedom of them, a anti-vaxxer, non-vaccinated person, was taking away from other people who still couldn't go to places because of individuals like them. Who had freedoms taken away from them because they had to say, you can't tell me what to do. So they took away other people's freedom. They never think about those people.
Yeah.
Those people, they're just they're disposable. Those people don't have real freedoms. They don't matter.
No, worse than that, they do think about other people's freedoms. Like, that's how Americans feel extra free, when at least a certain class of Americans, when they're trampling over other people's freedom. Like,
that's true
too. It goes all the way back to the United States as like the foundation of like a slave nation and a nation that was founded on genocide. A lot of Americans, and you know, have a hard time conceptualizing freedom, what freedom means outside of the dynamic of I'm taking away someone else's right. Like, freedom in America is like, where can I bring my gun and make people uncomfortable, but they can't legally allow me to go, they can't legally kick me out of, like, you know, how far can I put my hand in your face before like it becomes a crime? That's how Americans conceptualize freedom a lot of times. Like, what identity factors, what kind of day do I have to have before I deserve to be able to like afford to rent a slave and mistreat them on a delivery app without judgment? And, you know, you might say that all of those things, you can dress those up, but at their core, they are not the, you know, the mental hangups of a dynamic society or a society that can handle the dynamic dynamism that's necessary in a world where like climate catastrophes happening all the time, like pandemics, because it means that we're so rigid, and so much of our freedom is about like, can I sneeze in your face without wearing a mask? And if you go like, I don't think that we should be thinking like that. People go like, in the Constitution, it says that I need to be allowed to do that. And you go like, well, maybe it does, but I don't think that's good. And then, you know, because of our, again, like our civil rights issues, like it just doesn't go anywhere because we have so many hangups.
Yep. There's a book. I'm looking up the source in my library here. Yeah. American Slavery, American Freedom is a great history of how, exactly our definition of liberty was developed in part by slave drivers, almost in full by slave drivers who considered it, the ability to bring a gun and slaves into areas and have the government protect that right for their happiness, the happiness of the slave owners. Some IMs here. The Kirk cover-up with the FBI is obviously to hide the evidence of mRNA vac side effect, sudden neck failure, which Big Pharma tested Epstein before the start of the pandemic. That's from Kirk the Throat Goat. Let's see here. Preach, Matt. I love hearing IMs like that. You know, the funny thing is, look up a Dave Rubin video from 2015 of with Cara Santamaria, who is of the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, where he talks about how crazy it is that these lefty hippies don't want to get their kids vaccinated. And now what's he doing is completely peddling that same thing, because none of these people have anything remotely close to principles here. I got sidetracked on something that I wanted to get to. And I don't know if this is going to be able to be included in the Bill Maher clip, but Bill Maher talking about, everyone wants to define me as like not good enough, these far left woke people. Here's a clip from, I believe, 1997. I don't know if it says they're on there. It's old. I'll maybe Google it, but it's when Christopher Hitchens' book, The Trial, Christopher Hitchens' book, The Trial of Henry Kissinger, came out. So we are talking about a long time ago. And here is Bill Maher talking about Vietnam. And I'll just say, like, this seems to me like the opinion of a right-wing zealot, not someone I would consider on the left. Here's Bill Maher. If you want to full screen that, maybe, or you can play it how you want. That's good.
Great writers, I have to say. I don't agree with everything in here.
You're not supposed to.
Right. It's about Henry Kissinger, and, you know, you're not the first to say that he is responsible for a lot of the atrocities in Indochina. And, of course, with the Bob Kerry situation all in the news, I've been hearing nothing but Vietnam the last couple of weeks. And I have to tell you, it bothers me that there is this conventional wisdom that is in every article I hear, every article I read, every news report I hear about Vietnam was a wasted war. We should never have gone. I have said many times on the show, I thought it was a necessary war. You know, it was very nice for Ronald Reagan, an actor playing the president, to go over to the Berlin Wall and say, tear down that wall. That is not what won the Cold War. That was a wonderful money shot.
It's true.
What it was a good photo op. What won the Cold War was we demonstrating to the bullies of the world that we would put ourselves on the line and spend lives. The Vietnam War didn't have to happen in Vietnam, but it had to happen somewhere.
I think the problem, sorry to interrupt.
Pause it. Because Gene Simmons.
I was wondering if that was Gene Simmons.
Yes. It was Gene Simmons, yep.
We had to spend those lives somewhere. We had to get people taken down in helicopters in the jungle across the world somewhere to prove that we'll stand up to bullies. People should remember, Ho Chi Minh cited Thomas Jefferson's Declaration of Independence when Vietnam was trying to have a decolonial revolution against the French. And America decided, you know what? We actually aren't ready for that. We're going to step in where France's colonialists leave, and we're going to prop up an entire puppet government that we're going to insist has a right to defend itself, and we're going to arm that right. And in that case, we're never able to get the numbers with the fake puppet regime, and it failed. It was a complete. It was evil. The Vietnam War was evil. There's not two sides to it. Nobody, and it's not just evil because American soldiers died for it. Well, that isn't part of it, because like we're talking about the different sorts of like lack of caring. For Vietnam, you know who really needed Vietnam to happen somewhere was the defense contractors, like Bell Helicopter. Because every single time that one of those helicopters went down into a jungle, Bell Helicopter got to make a new helicopter and sell it to the government. Like, the idea that this was for freedom or standing up to bullies is so fucking stupid. And, I mean, Hitchens later gets it. We don't need to play it, but people can look up. It's part of the good Hitchens before he was like defending the Iraq War. But, yeah, it's appalling. And Bill Maher does not represent me. I have not felt represented by Bill Maher as somebody on the left for, I don't know, a long time. I even thought as a teenage atheist, I thought Religulous was fucking ham-fisted and stupid. But the idea that somebody who, like Bill Maher, who's going to defend Israel and everything going on there on the basis of the Bible says so, which he has done. This is a guy who is supposedly an atheist. Like, he is it's a sham. Like, people should remove Bill Maher from their media diet at this point. If they're listening to this program and somehow also still checking in on Bill Maher, which I did for a while, because look, I appreciate that he releases the audio for his show on podcast form. That was useful to me in 2008. Got to move on from these guys. Got to move on from them.
Even Jeffrey Epstein didn't want to hang out with them.
Oh yeah, he's not in the files. Disappointing surprise. I mean, but that's the other thing is like Bill Maher talking about this Hollywood stuff, and like Hollywood, you're making it troublesome. Okay, you went to Mar-a-Lago to have dinner with Trump and Kid Rock. Who are you? Some policy guy? No. Let's take a few more IMs here. I feel like I'm going nuts. How are more people not outraged by pedos running our country? How is no one in jail in America? Well, a guy did get thrown in jail, and then he died under suspicious circumstances, and it was either killed or he was allowed to kill himself. And I'm not. Do you guys have any opinions on the Epstein thing at this juncture? Like, I've always been sort of agnostic about whether he was given the or there's the new theory that he's still alive.
I don't think he's still alive.
Yeah, he's not. I don't think he's still alive either. Those images that keep being shared online of like a bearded guy who looks like Epstein in Israel or whatever. I saw a debunk where someone looked into the original poster of that like Reddit history, and they've been posting obvious AI images of that same AI created guy for many times. Like, it's not like, oh, I was just in Israel and I saw this guy walk by and I snapped a photo, like in different outfits in different places. So it's not like you just ran into a guy and then maybe that's Jeffrey Epstein. Like, it's someone's creating these images of this guy. So
it strikes me as the way that certain conspiracy theories get sort of Alex Jonesified with more maximalist claims made about them to kind of discredit everything else that's going on, which is that clearly one of two things happened with Jeffrey Epstein in prison in Manhattan, which is that there was some shadiness that allowed him to get access to enough fucking blankets to kill himself, or he was murdered. Those are the two options, and both of them is a conspiracy.
Yeah. Well, I mean, no, I don't know, so I'm not going to speculate on exactly what happened, but I'll say the case for him either being killed or given the ability to kill himself is getting stronger and stronger with each one of these releases.
Yep.
Well, I would say I think at the floor now, after seeing some of the released images of what his cell looked like with all that fabric that he could use to kill himself, there were like, and if the photo that I am thinking of was actually taken of his cell at the time or after his death, there were enough like, you know, essentially like blankets or whatever for him to kill himself by eating them at that point.
Yeah.
And so
or Rapunzel out.
Yeah, so it's at the most basic level, he was not being subjected, much like Ghislaine Maxwell is not being subjected to the same standards that you – the same standards that you would expect to be followed with a person of his stature in this particular case. And so I think that's the minimum that we can say. Whether or not he killed himself willingly, or he was forced to kill himself, or someone actually went in there and garroted him and they just like left like stuff around, I don't think that we can say, right? But I think we have to be comfortable with that lack of perfect knowledge. What I think, though, is that to your point about people like Alex Jones in conspiracies, I think a lot of times when you Alex Jones conspiracies, it's to soften them. It's to make them seem like less bad than they are. And that's what I think of the Epstein is still alive conspiracy. Because, you know, if you believe Epstein is still alive, that's like believing that, like, well, there's only one Epstein. So, like, he has to be still alive because he was so important. He was so important that, like, no one would ever dare to kill him because, like, who else would run this organization? Epstein was, like, a stand-in. He was a cutout for somebody. Something, right? Like, he wasn't the only one. He's probably still not the only one who is doing it now. And so to believe that Epstein is still alive, I think fits in people's belief that, like, no, Epstein was so singular, like great man pedal theory. Epstein was so singular to this kind of thing that without Epstein's being alive, you know, it can't keep going, or like, you know, like they would never kill him because like there's no one like him. There's probably another Epstein already. Like, you know, it's the same thing with the Maduro situation or any cartel that Trump is trying to allege exists. Even if it did work that way, like, you know, if you just kill the head of the organization, it doesn't fall apart except for in extreme cases. And it doesn't seem like this was, you know, despite Epstein's eccentricities, it doesn't seem like this was an unsophisticated operation.
Yeah. Right. I mean, what strikes me when I see the releases, the emails, is how recent a lot of the emails were. Like, these aren't just like a bunch of emails from a decade ago. Some of the, I mean, a decade before he died, I should say. These are emails that were from the days before. So to me, it didn't come across as a guy who was spiraling, knew something was going to, you know, this was the end for him. And he gets arrested, he goes to jail. And this is in a situation where that's that he's not familiar with. He's faced this before and got away with it. So the idea that he wouldn't think he's gonna, you know, get out of it again, so he had to kill himself. That seems suspicious to me.
Leftist big pharma plug. I've said it before, but I'll repeat. The fundamental issue has always been the lack of sufficient education about communicable diseases and basic science in K-12. That was an intentional choice in the past. The general underinformed public, at least had more trust in government to still take vaccines when they were made available. But without basic education, with an erosion of trust in government, we stand to lose everyone to their own ignorance, skepticism, and a chatty-ass grifter. I mean, I think that points to a broader point. And it's not just education, but our entire systems in general. So, like, public education, obviously, I think is a huge component of it. It needs to be strengthened. We need to invest massively in public education. But Abdullah Sayed has the good politician answer for this, which is less the, like, me calling people dumb babies and more insane. Our system of private healthcare in this country fosters paranoia and insecurity. I read a study in the FT, which is about people getting, I think it was MRIs. They pass on average like three cheaper MRI providing facilities on their way to the place that their doctor told them to, because people don't actually want to shop for the cheapest MRI provider when their doctor tells them something. The entire system is set, like, you can't go to people after saying, after price discriminating them out of healthcare forever and say, we actually need you to take this vaccine. People are going to be suspicious about why they're getting for free. You saw all sorts of people saying it. And that is fundamentally why I think other countries had a better reaction to these efforts than ours.
Not just that, I would say, like, you know, even going further, the kind of neoliberal propaganda that convinces people to only care about themselves, to lack empathy for their community, the kind of antisocial propaganda goes hand in hand with that, right? Because it's like, it's very hard to explain to people why they should do something that they feel like will inconvenience them at all if it's only to, like, you know, improve society as a whole, because people just don't see the value of that. That's the kind of the Margaret Thatcher thing, not to mention another British prime minister right after Winston Churchill. But if the smallest unit of that you should care about, society, is your family, why should I do anything outside of what I consider best for my family? Like, how do you make it sense with make it make sense within like the hyper individualistic neoliberal framework that has been, you know, foisted upon so many people that like, well, even if you don't think that you want it, do it for the community. We don't care about the community. Everyone's at each other's necks. It's a zero sum game. Why would I do that? And I do think that there is an element of this that is bipartisan that is present in our media, not just the anti-science, their rational thinking, but the, you know, the anti-social thinking that they want people to be able to turn off immediately, like you're saying. Like they want people to have this because it makes them easier to scam. It makes them easier to trick into like the two-party system duopoly. But when they really need you to do something, whether it's not vote for Trump or like, you know, to get the vaccine, they want you to forget all of the conditioning, forget all of the context, forget everything you've been like trained to think like and go like, just stop it. Just like, just spontaneously develop proper training. And it's just not reasonable. And it's really easy to understand all of the different ways people are disincentivized from caring about public health or getting vaccines. But so many of them intersect with the things that people, at least in power, need to be true in order for them to like convince you to like not rise up.
Yep. Jordy PhD, a similar point. It's also the long-term fetishization of rugged individualism and demonization of collective action and empathy. I mean, maybe, I don't know. I remember at the start of COVID thinking about the people who lived in my building and how horrible I would feel if I brought in a fucking disease and killed one of them. And I just don't understand how it wasn't obvious to people. But somebody asked if I can put on the Schumer glasses. NYC transit worker, Matt, can you please do a Schumer impression with the glasses? And I'll please. Well, I do have the glasses here. Put them on. But I can't do, I don't have a good Chuck Schumer impression, so I'm not even going to start that. let's see a few more IMs here, and then we will call it a day. I'm an ICU nurse, and I started in 2020. It changed me as a person. I never realized until then how fucking selfish Americans are. I mean, it is a civilization problem. And we need to do more comparative. Like, the only time America was ever really performing was when we thought the USSR was going to kick our ass in, like, the space race and stuff like that. And ever since the fall of the Soviet Union, like, it's very clear, like, all of these people, the Epstein class, has not felt any sort of urgency about the actual position of capitalism in this world. And I got news for you. We are being surpassed, folks. By the time, like, your kids are our age, America, the idea that America is like the world leader in like economic production, stuff like that, is going to be long gone. You just look at the way Asian countries reacted to the bird flu, and they just sensibly decided, well, you know what, when I'm sick, I'm going to put on a mask. And we turned it into the dumb, like a dumb culture war. Like, just, I mean, stupid pig-headed
country. It will be a banana republic that the bananas are just warheads.
Yeah, exactly. But then, even then, it's like our nukes are running on floppy disks.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's because, I mean, that's such a good point. It's because ultimately a lot of our military spending is a boondoggle. Yeah. And a lot of Americans, even who should know better, cope by going like, okay, yeah, we may not have anything that other countries have, but if we need to like bomb Iran, if we need to like invade a country, we're going to do it. We couldn't even beat the Houthis in the Red Sea. People are like, oh no, we abandoned that. We abandoned Vietnam. We abandoned Afghanistan. Like, what is this money for? We dropped those $8 million bombs each on Iran, and their nuclear facility got more powerful. Like, so a lot of people cope with this idea of, you know, you see it sometimes when someone strikes at America and people, you're going to find out why America doesn't have healthcare. It's like, no, they don't have healthcare because billionaires control our society, not because our weapons are good. Like, it's good when we're bombing people we have kept in, you know, kept at a lower level of military development. But when it comes to fighting against like a China, people imagine the United States would beat China. We couldn't even beat the Houthis. Like, why would that be the case? But it's just another way people cope.
Yeah, not a chance. Not a chance in hell. And meanwhile, they've connected all their largest cities, hundreds of them, with high-speed rail. And how long does it take to take a train from New York to Chicago?
2-3 days.
About a day and a half at least. And that's as airplane tickets rise and rise and rise.
As airplanes fall out of the sky.
But anyway, isn't communism so bad? Folks, I think that's going to be it for this Thursday for the boys edition of Majority Report. Matt Binder and Brandon Sutton, thank you so much for joining us once again.
It was a pleasure, as always.
Thank you. Yeah.
I look forward to seeing you guys again next week. And Until then, we'll be back tomorrow with a new show, folks. We'll see you then.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in. And my pilot light's shining bright. I guess I'm where the choice is made. The option where you don't get paid for the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I guess somehow I lost my drive between the 101 and the 5. Do you know how far the detour takes you? Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick. My pilot light shining bright. The months shifted into years while I shifted in and out of gear.